Hi folks, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carl. Welcome you to the latest podcast from the Banter team. Every year we host a Banter event as part of the first Fortnite Mental Health Arts Creative Festival, and this year we were joined at Dublin's Sugar Club by snooker legend Willie Thorne. The man known as Mr. Maximum talked to us about his career on and off the table and the many troubles and problems he's faced because of addiction and depression.
Hi everybody, welcome along to First Fortnite here at the Sugar Club. My name is Jim Carroll. Thanks a million to First Fortnite for asking me to host this as part of our ongoing banter series. The man with me needs no introduction whatsoever. Please give a warm round of applause to Willie Thorne.
Thank you very much indeed, thank you.
Welcome back to Dublin.
Absolute pleasure. I mean, I've just spent a couple of hours with my great friend Ken Doherty. He's took me for lunch, which is unusual for Ken. He never usually buys anything, but no, it's great. We have done lots of radio things since I've been here, and I'm just really pleased I've come over because, obviously, as you know, I've had a few problems myself, and which I'm sure you're going to talk about.
Okay, we'll get to those problems. Let's start, I suppose, with the bright sparks, Willie, in many ways. You know, when you started out, first of all, playing snooker, playing billiards, as it was, like, at what stage did you realise you were damn good at the game?
After about 6 months, I was very, very lucky. My father was a miner, and the mine closed, and he took a job as a steward at a conservative club. And all of a sudden, that conservative club had got a full-size table in. And because I'd played on a small 6-foot by 3-foot table like your children can have at home and things like that, I'd got the interest. And after 6 months, I'd made a century break. So all of a sudden, I then went down to the local billiard hall, which was a retrograde step, really, because obviously the local billiard halls, you've got, you know, people who gamble, people who thieve, people who drink, people who take drugs and things like that. So it wasn't the best kind of way to get started. But, of course, I was playing then better players in the billiard hall, whereas in the conservative club, the standard was very, very poor. And then, obviously, got better and better, and a guy called Whispering Ted Lowe. Do you remember Whispering Ted Lowe from snooker? You know, he had that lovely whispering voice, didn't he? But never guessed a shot right, but had a lovely whispering voice. He invited me to play on Pot Black. And, of course, that's the rest is history. Then I turned pro in 1976. And I'm just going to turn my phone off just in case it rings. And then, got involved playing all the time.
Yeah. So, like, you know, you quickly kind of, like, realised, I suppose, that you're going to make more money and have more fun playing snooker than you were going to be working as an estimator for a local class firm. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, that was my first job. Obviously, your parents always want you to have a job, you know. And as was mentioned, I was an estimator at a glass company for a while. And after about a year, I was earning 2 or 3 times the money because in my era, I mean, when I turned pro at 21 years of age, I was the youngest pro in the world. And, of course, now people are 15, 16 years of age and playing. So, you know, I turned pro, like, which was very, very young at the time. I mean, Ray Reardon didn't turn pro till he was 35. So it wasn't like an older man's game. And, of course, I was the youngest pro in the world for quite some time.
Mm. Like, those early years, like, I mean, Willie, when you were on the pro circuit, you know, I mean, obviously, you're a young lad, right? And so you're there, you're playing against older players. They look upon you as this kind of cocky newcomer coming up. Did you kind of enjoy putting them right? Or, like, I mean, what was the atmosphere like on the tour?
Well, in fairness, even though I was good enough to be a pro at that time, I wasn't good enough mentally to be a pro at that time. I played Graham Miles in the first World Championship I played in at the Crucible Theatre Sheffield. And Graham Miles beat me, I think, 10-6. And in fairness, if I'd have been playing Graham Miles in a billiard hall for a few quid, I'd have probably beat him 10-2. You know, I mean, you know, it's just that I never had the temperament for the big time game. So I actually turned pro, perhaps a little bit too early, but it was an offer I couldn't refuse by playing on Pot Black, which was the biggest sports program at the time. You know, I mean, Question of Sport was now the longest running sports program. Pot Black was the previous longest running sports program, so it was important to be on that.
Mm. I mean, that mentality when it comes to the big game, like, do you think, you know, in many ways, did you ever develop that properly? I mean, you've kind of, like, said at many stages in your career, you know, that you often look back at the way you were at the very start and how you played at the very start and your kind of approach to the game. Do you think, you know, that, like, did you ever kind of develop that kind of, like, killer edge?
Not at all. I mean, I was one of those people that, a bit like the Jimmy White, Ronnie O'Sullivan, I wanted to get on with it and entertain people and try and win nicely. I didn't learn how to win scruffy. You know, I mean, the great Dennis Taylor, of course, he was allegedly not as good as I, but obviously he won more championships than I, and of course won the World Championship. I mean, Ken Doherty is a great player, you know, but I know at my time I was probably as good as those people, but didn't get over the line. I mean, it all happened many, many years ago when And one of the matches that some of you may remember, I played Steve Davis in the final of the UK Championship, and I'm leading 13-8. And Gary Lineker was always with me at that time, always used to come and watch me play and all the rest of it. And he was commuting back and to from Preston to go back to Leicester. And at the time, his sponsored car was a Fiat Uno. This is absolutely serious. His sponsored car was a Fiat Uno. And I said, Gary, you can't be coming up and down the motorway. I said, take my car, because I'd got a Mercedes or something at the time. So he was going back to training to see my car. But it was Gary Lineker's fault. I lost in the final of the UK Championship. I'm 13-8 in front. We've gone back to the hotel. He said, look, the night session is about to start. Whatever you do, just make sure you win the first frame, and then it's impossible for Davis to beat you because he's going to have to beat you 8-1. And obviously that's impossible. So we've gone to the first frame in the evening, and I'm about 60-odd points behind, and I'm clearing up, and I've now got a blue that everybody in this audience would have potted. I don't know whether anybody saw that UK Championship. You're all far too young, actually, looking in the audience. But
YouTube's great for that.
I've got a blue. Well, if you look on YouTube, it's a blue, honestly, you couldn't miss. And I've just relaxed. I wasn't nervous on the shot. I missed this blue. And this is how weak mentally I was. And this is what made me realise over the years how negative I was. I've gone back to my chair. I'm leading 13-9. And now I'm thinking about losing. That's how negative I was. And that stayed with me all my life. After that UK Championship, there's probably three or four other occasions where I think I was 9-7 in front of Werbenek, lost 10-9. I was 12-9 in front against Eddie Charlton, who'd send a glass eye to sleep. I lost 13-12. I mean, there were so many slow players in my era, wasn't there? I mean, Cliff Thorburn, Terry Griffiths. I mean, goodness me. I mean, Steve Davis obviously came on the scene. And, like I said, I played him in the final of the UK Championship. And I think if I'd have won that one, I would have probably gone on to win the World Championship a couple of times because I was definitely good enough, but mentally I was so weak. And that one match made my mental side so bad. I'd get to winning positions and I'd be down on a shot sometimes thinking about what happens if I miss this. You know, how negative is that? But in my era, there was no sports psychologist. There was no positive mental attitude books. Didn't know anything about that in my game, so it was different.
I mean, aside from that, that story illustrating the point that we should all be happy that Gary Lineker and everyone into football management, it also throws up a kind of point about solo sports people and kind of that mental fragility, when you and your peers, when you and the other players were talking at night after games or whatever, did you discuss mental pressure in that way, or was it something that looked upon as a weakness?
Once again, didn't know anything about it. We never did. I mean, Gary obviously, was trying to be a bit positive by saying, look, win the first frame and you can't lose. But what we never talked about, what happens if you lose the first frame? That never crossed in the conversation. And of course, that time I couldn't handle it. And, it's cost me. I mean, that's, I think, my negativity has caused a problem in my life, which we'll talk about a little bit later on.
Yeah. And the other thing about that particular era as well, in the early 1980s, Willie, was that snooker was full of characters, Mm. I mean, this is the whole thing. I mean, people can remember what it was like. They can actually remember because you all have personalities, individual kind of colourful personalities. Barry Hearn put together the single as well. You couldn't imagine something like that happening right now. When you look back and you look at all those kind of all the characters that were there, do you think some of it was kind of amplified? Some of it, there was caricatures as opposed to characters?
I think we were very, very lucky. We were around in the 80s when the game was as big as it could have been. It was the number one sport in Great Britain at that time because football was going through the crowd violence and, everybody kind of took snooker into their hearts. I was very, very lucky to be around when there was only four television channels. Of course, these days you've got 150 television channels, so consequently it's not quite as easy to become a personality. And we had some wonderful characters. I mean, the great Alex Higgins was around at the time. Dennis Taylor obviously won the World Championship in 85. And there was 18.5 million viewers after midnight watched that game, which is by far and away a record for sport. I mean, obviously, normally after midnight, there's only Terry Griffiths and Cliff Thorburn playing. Everybody else has gone home. But that particular World Championship, there was Dennis went on until the early hours. And it was great. I mean, so popular was snooker at the time that the Sports Council got involved in our game where we had to take drug tests at the end of each tournament. I mean, I wouldn't say that any of our players were on drugs, but Kirk Stevens sneezed and we felt great for the rest of the day. But and, of course, this happens. I mean, when you have to take a drug test, I'm sure you've all been to the doctors. I mean, you get the little sample jar, you have to give your sample. Different players in our game have different ways of wanting to give their sample. You may remember snooker's sex symbol, Tony Knowles. He wanted to do his drug sample out on the table with everybody watching. Dennis Taylor once did it with his glasses off and missed the bottle completely. Cliff Thorburn took so long over his, it went off before it got there. And Big Bill Werber, remember Big Bill? He used to drink all that lager. Used to carry his out in a bucket when they finished with Big Bill. I'm going to tell you one quick story about Big Bill, just to diversify. I mean, Bill Werbeneck, as you may or may not remember, used to try and claim tax relief for his lager intake. This is absolutely true. He was having so much lager, he thought, well, I'm sure I can get tax relief because it's my job. And, of course, then all the publicans were complaining, so it never got passed. Once again, you may not remember that when Bill Werbeneck played, he had a pint per frame. Because after every frame, he used to waddle off to the loo, come back with another pint. I was playing him in the latter stages of the UK Championship, I think the same year that Davis beat me in the final. It was the year before because he beat me. So what happened, I knew he had a pint per frame. I knew he had a trapped nerve. I held a coffee cup in his left hand and be perfectly still. Coffee cup in his right hand would shake terribly. So the only thing he found, because he couldn't take a banned drug that showed up in his test, was alcohol to calm the nerves. As I said, I knew by watching him on the television he had a pint per frame. Now I'm playing him in the best of 19 over two sessions, right? So I'm thinking to myself, I'm up at breakfast at 7:30 in the morning getting ready for the 11 o'clock match. I look over in the corner, ladies and gentlemen, this is absolutely God's honest truth. Werbeneck has got 8 pints of lager on his breakfast table. So obviously he couldn't just play with 1 pint and expect to play. He had to have so much alcohol in his system to get the nerve right. I found out it was 8 pints. So I'm now saying to my friends, I said, look, he's going to have 8 pints before we start. We're playing best of 19. He's likely to be pissed before the end of this game. I've had the biggest bet on myself I've ever had in my life, which if you read my autobiography, you know that's a few quid, right? The match started, so it was 8 pints before we start. We played the first 9 frames, 8 and 9 is 17. He went on black coffee for a few hours in the afternoon. Out again for the night session, another 8 pints of lager. 8 and 9 is 17, another 8 is 25. Ladies and gents, the match went the full 19 frames. He's had 35 pints of lager. He beat me 10-9. True story. True story.
Well, while we're on stories, Will, have you got some story about Alex Higgins and a teddy bear?
We used to play a tournament at the Canadian exhibition, the CNE it was called, in Toronto. And we'd been going over there, and they had hockey matches on, basketball matches on. It was a really big event. And we had the first building going into the Queen's Gate and where we had the snooker tournament. Because a long story short, there was a fairground going on at the time, and I'd been trying to win one of these big, massive teddy bears that were about 4 feet tall to take home for my girlfriend at the time. Anyway, I'd probably spent 150 quid trying to win one that was probably worth 50 quid, but so I never won one, so I'm depressed and everything, and I'm going to buy, I have to get my girlfriend something to take home. Higgins, on the last day, the last but one day, I should say, has walked in with this big, massive teddy bear. Hello, Williamson, I've won this teddy bear. I said, oh, great, well done. We're playing cards that night. And as usual, Alex, like myself, wasn't the best loser in the world. All of a sudden, he's losing his money. I've lent him a few quid. He's carried on playing. He said, Willie, he said, lend me another 200 quid. I said, Alex, I said, no. He said, well, buy my teddy bear off me. And I thought, perfect, because I wanted a teddy bear for the girlfriend. I said, look, I'll give you 100 quid for the teddy bear so you can carry on playing cards. I said, but Alex, don't ask for it back. The night finished playing. I said, Alex, I've got this teddy bear. I said, look, tomorrow we're leaving at 4 o'clock. I said, tell me you're not going to ask for the teddy bear. Oh, of course, I don't want the teddy bear. I didn't buy it for anybody. With our 30,000 feet up in the air, Alex is pissed. I want my teddy bear back. I said, Alex, as you know now, my girlfriend's picking me up at the airport. You can't have your teddy bear back. We are now knocking 10 bells of shit out of each other, 30,000 feet in the air. I mean, he was such a nuisance, Alex, but I loved him. I mean, down to colour television and Alex Higgins, the game is where it is. And so let's be grateful for that. But he was nuts. He was nuts.
You've mentioned there kind of a couple of instances of yourself betting on yourself on matches. But betting on yourself wasn't your kind of first, I suppose, like immersion into gambling. That came a long time before that.
Yeah, my father, like I said, was a miner and liked the horses, so he was having a small bet. When he went from the
conservative... When you say a small bet, what
like... No, he'd only be betting £50 or something like that. And then my father, after leaving the conservative club, we had a pub in probably the roughest area in Leicester, but it was a really good pub. Had a snooker table put in upstairs, and then he owned a horse. This is when I'm now 18 years of age, and he owned a horse called Lana's Secret, which actually won about 5 races. So, of course, you know, I'm betting my pocket money on it. At the time, I was gambling in the snooker club, so I was having 100 quid on his horse and things like that and got the bug. And, of course, then afterwards, I was having more and more on. And, of course, that was the problem. In our era, there was so much money around in the 80s. You know, to get to a quarterfinal, you'd be guaranteed like 15 or 20 grand or something to get to a quarterfinal. And because I was always in the top 8 at that time, it meant that I couldn't meet any of the other top 8 players until that stage. And so I'd always, you know, be gambling, thinking, well, it doesn't matter if I lose this week because I'm guaranteed 20 grand next week. You know, that's how stupid it was. And that's how it spiraled out of control.
But like, say I'm curious about, like, I mean, the first time you walked into kind of the bidders hall, and you were meeting people like, say, Racing Raymond, or like Relentless Reg, and there's another guy as well. All these incredibly colourful characters. They see you coming in. I mean, they're gamblers. I mean, they're as far as they're concerned, this is part of their life. Did they kind of like encourage you? Did they try and kind of like, I mean, steer you on a different plat? Or
absolutely. They... I mean, what actually happened with all the characters we're talking about in the club? Obviously, they'd realise they'd got. I mean, as I mentioned earlier on, I was by far and away the best player in the country at like 18, 19 and 20. So I was going to Billy Doors because there was no television watching me play at that particular stage. So we were turning up in Billy Doors playing for like £1,000 or £2,000 against their top player. And of course, because they hadn't seen me before, they're thinking, how can this young kid, like, you know, like 18 years of age, play me? I'm like 30 and one of the best players in Manchester or whatever. And of course, I was far too good for them. So we won an awful lot of money gambling. And of course, that's why the colourful characters follow me around. And yeah. They won many, many thousands of pounds. I mean, if I hadn't found horses, I'd have been kind of quite rich, really.
let's talk a bit about that. Like, I mean, the kind of the gambling on the horses, really, because, you know, I mean, it's one of those things. Like, your father had horses, so, like, I mean, you were kind of like, obviously kind of like able to read the form and follow the form. Did you find that when you were kind of like gambling on horses, that like you thought you were invincible in many ways, or was it a case of you were gambling on horses because you thought the next race, I might win the next race, and that would solve everything?
I think it was all about bravado, because once I turned pro, I mean, the height of gambling, I wasn't doing it until I was probably 30, 35, when I was really having ridiculous amounts of money on. And I think it's bravado. You go to the races and, oh, there's Willie Thorne, what's he backing today? And I had my first snooker club in Newmarket. Henry Cecil was one of my closest friends, and you know, so obviously he was the number one trainer at the time. Steve Cawthon used to come into the club, and so I knew when he was going to be off one horse and on another horse. So it was insider trading, as it were. And, you know, if I lost... The thing is with gambling, if you lost all the time, you wouldn't do it. Obviously, you have your wins now and again. So, you know, you don't become a compulsive gambler or a person that wants to gamble all the time if you didn't win. I mean, obviously, if you lost all the time, you wouldn't play. And so I got plenty of information. And because you get an information, I'm sure there's maybe one or two gamblers in the room. Say, for instance, you're going in to back a horse and you're going to have a tenner on it. If somebody next to you said, look, I've just had a word from the trainer, this is definitely going to win today, the one you're going to back. So you'd have 30 quid on it or whatever. And that was the multiples where I and sometimes I'd be ringing up, I had about 40 different accounts at one time when I was at the height of my kind of juggling the balls around. And I'd be ringing up to probably have £3,000 or £4,000 on a horse or something. By the time I get through to the racing manager, it's gone up, I'm having 10,000 on. By the time I've gone to check whether it's okay, I'm having 12,000 on. So, you know, I'm ringing up to have 2,000 on or 5,000 on. I've ended up having 12 on. So, unfortunately, in the betting industry, like when you go to the casino, why do they give you gambling chips? Because they don't want to be, because they know it's worth nothing. You know, when you're pulling money out of your back pocket, it means something. When you've got chips in front of you, it means nothing. And it's the same with gambling. If there wasn't, the thing that sport Great Britain over the years, without any question, are credit cards and credit. If you didn't have credit cards, didn't have credit, the country would be in a lot better place, because everybody goes overboard at Christmas. Everybody, when they've got credit, they've got £1,000 worth of credit with Ladbrokes, they're happy to do the £1,000. Whereas if they had to pull the £1,000 up, they wouldn't do it. Mm.
And obviously, as well, I mean, all the kind of, I mean, bookmakers on course or the bookmakers off course were quite happy in many ways to see Willie Thorne coming, because, I mean, you were a celebrity.
Yeah, and also you'd have a following, you know, people, because I knew I went to Newmarket quite a lot, knew they wouldn't be thinking I'd just be backing anything. I mean, obviously, now and again, you know, the biggest problem with me, I was not what I could call a compulsive gambler. I know that sounds strange with, you know, what's happened to me in my life, but I didn't have a bet every day. I never went into the Ladbrokes every day. I never looked at a paper. If somebody rang me to tell me something, that's when I'd have a bet. Mm. I was quite disciplined for a while, till the last few years.
But like, what's your view now, say, on kind of like on the way the gambling industry, the way that kind of like those big bookmakers like Paddy Power and Ladbrokes have inveigled their way into kind of like society? I mean, do you look upon them kind of like as irresponsible in many ways, or do you put it back onto personal responsibility?
Definitely personal responsibility. But when people are going online, I mean, they don't know how old they are. I mean, sometimes it's been heard that bookmakers have given accounts to people under 18. Obviously, then find out, you know, with where they do it. But I mean, like I say, it's just getting credit. I mean, anybody in this room could ring up Paddy Power and say, look, I'm thinking of opening a credit account. They'd look to make sure you're not kind of a bankrupt or you've got credit cards, and they'd give you £1,000 credit straight away. They wouldn't even blink about it, you know. So all of a sudden, you can have £1,000 on a horse. Obviously, the bigger, you know, celeb. I mean, all my credit accounts I'd got a £25,000 limit. So with those 14, 20 accounts, so I could, if I wanted to, I could have had £25,000 with each of them. But it's just stupid. You just lose all concept of money when you've got credit. You know, now if I go out for dinner, you know, I mean, this is why I can't understand people when they're kind of rude to waiters and things like that. I mean, I couldn't possibly be rude to anybody like that when they're working to serve you and things. And I just think it's such a horrible way of being when, you know, the point I'm trying to make is when you having everything your own way, it becomes too easy sometimes, you know. And I always think, you know, when I'm having a meal, that I think they're there to help me and things. I would never complain. I don't think I've ever sent a meal back in my life, even if I didn't like it. And I've always tipped. Because, you know, I mean, people are so rude to people. I mean, God bless his soul, Tony Drago is just terrible with waiters and things like that. And so rude, I can't believe it sometimes. It makes me cringe. Anyway.
I mean, in the autobiography, the last autobiography, it's really funny. It's a very funny story, and like when I was reread it again and remembered the story during the week, I was saying it was a great story. But at the same time, it was quite sad because it was a story about you coming back from the Irish Masters in Goffs, with you had your money from the tournament. I think it was about 25,000 Irish punts, but you also had 100,000 Irish punts that you'd won from betting on yourself, and you hid the money in the lining of your Crombie coat.
Absolutely.
I mean,
this is nice because I for 2 years on the trot, I got to the final both years. Now, in that era, bookmakers weren't open on a Sunday, and there was no credit at that time. There was two bookmakers that used to always come to the Goffs for the Irish Masters. So, consequently, I got to the final both years on the trot, and every year, my friends, Racing Raymond, Red-Faced Man from Braunston, Billy the Dip, they all came over, because they're all having... So we started off, probably had £5,000 over to win the first game, and sometimes I was second favourite, because obviously I was playing the likes of Dennis, who just won the World Championship, and... You know, Dennis only beat me twice, but I mean, so consequently, I thought I would win. So we had £5,000 on there, so now we've got £12,500. Now I'm playing Cliff Thorburn, who I think I can definitely beat. I'm even money favourite. We're both even money that, mate. So we've had the £12,500 on, so we've got £25,000. And then playing Jimmy White in the semi final, I think, well, we're going to be big odds against, because Jimmy at the time was, you know, about number two in the world. And I think they made me 6-4 against to beat Jimmy White. We had the lot on there. So all of a sudden, we've got £125,000 wrapped around us. So fortunately, the bookmakers weren't open on a Sunday. So, of course, one of the years I lost to Steve Davis, that year when we had beaten Jimmy White in the semi-final. We did the same thing the next year, albeit we didn't win 125. I think we were winning about 40,000 when it got to the final. And luckily, we couldn't have a bet again. I lost again. So maybe if the bookmakers had been open on a Sunday, I'd have been very rich. But that's a true story.
Right. Like, I mean, like you're talking there about the people you knew from the Billiards Club, and like, I mean, they're coming along to the tournaments, you know. But like, they're not the only people coming along to tournaments. I'm curious about, like, I mean, your take on the whole match fixing thing which went on. Like, I mean, you know, and the way it kind of, excuse the pun, snookered Peter Francisco, you know, that, like, you know, was there pressure on you from characters? Was there pressure from people who knew maybe that Willie Torn was a big gambler, who knew Willie Torn was in the red sometimes?
Yeah, I got approached once. I was playing Joe Johnson in the first round of the Benson Hedges Masters, which is now the Masters that which starts tomorrow. And a guy, a telephone call, I didn't know it was, and said, Willie, would you consider getting, you know, throwing the match? So what are you talking about? I said, we'll give you £20,000 to lose the match tomorrow against Joe Johnson. And I thought, how disgusting. How could anybody get involved in a sport that you make a living out of? And of course, Joe Johnson, bless him, you know, he couldn't beat me if I fell over, you know. So I thought, well, how could I lose that much on purpose? So that was the only time I got approached. The Peter Francisco game that they're talking about, is it was a World Championship. Before the match started, we knew it was going to be 10-2. And I went into Peter Francisco's dressing room on the morning of the game. Sorry, excuse me. I said, Peter, do yourself a favour. Don't lose the match 10-2. If you're going to lose, make sure you don't lose 10-2, because everybody's like, I'm not crooked, really. I'm going to win this match, or I'm going to do my best, and things like that. Needless to say, I lost 10-2, and everybody got these betting slips for 10-2 and things like that. So that's the reason he got banned. Allegedly, John Higgins a few years ago was involved. The previous year, John Higgins and his management company had put on the World Series, and they'd lost a lot of money because they were putting on in Portugal, in Spain, in the summer. So nobody's going to go and watch snooker in the summer. And they lost about £250,000. All of a sudden, his management, they were playing in Russia or somewhere, and his management was offered. We said, would John lose frames, not matches, would John lose frames of 100,000? And they thought, well, I've just lost $250,000 there. It doesn't mean like we're losing matches on purpose. Maybe I'll put this to John. When John went into the room, and this is allegedly where he got away with it, because, of course, he's sitting like in a round table having a little chat about the game, and the management brought it up, and John said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, look, we'll put £100,000 in your bank account, whether it be Spain or wherever it is, if you lose the first frame in one match and maybe another certain frame in another match. And John allegedly said he thought it was mafia and he thought he wanted to get out of there alive, which is... And, of course, he apparently accepted, but obviously that never took place, the match, because obviously it was News of the World people, and they'd put underground people in to try and sell him down the river. And John Higgins served a six-month ban, which, in my humble opinion, should have been 2 years at least, yeah, because... Stephen Lee, he's just been blatantly caught. I mean, Stephen Lee was banned for 12 years a few years ago, and you'll never see him again, and he's a great player. I mean, he's earning like $400,000 a year, $300,000 a year. And he's trying to get an extra $10,000 on a fixed match. Just lose.
It's bonkers.
Bonkers, absolutely bonkers.
And like, I mean, obviously, like, you know, you're someone who, like, I mean, commentates now on games and matches, and you know what's going on in terms of, like, I mean, sports media. Do you think kind of, like, that kind of match fixing, that sort of, like, I mean, that kind of criminal element is widespread in sports or is certain sports?
It's just because it's so easy to make money. I mean, once again, I don't know whether you're bettors out there, but I mean, the Premiership footballers are all at it. When they were betting on spread betting on what time the first throw-in was, right? They won fortunes betting on this. The Premiership players, because all they were doing, they were passing it to the side, and the fellow was allegedly trying to kick it to the wingman and knocking it out of touch. So all of a sudden, after 9 seconds or 8 seconds, there was a throw-in. They used to bet on under or over 30 seconds being the first throw-in. Of course, they've banned all that now. There's no bet. So even the Premiership footballers are at it. When you've got a chance of doing things like on snooker, there was they had a tournament many years ago where they were betting on what was the first colour potted. Well, of course, the players just thought, well, we'll make the blue the first ball potted. You know, so it wasn't crooked, but all of a sudden the bookmakers have given them a chance to win money for nothing. So if they potted a red, they wouldn't go for another colour bar the blue. It was just like, you know, it's insider trading almost, you know.
Do you think the reason why an awful lot of people, like sports people like yourself, get caught up in gambling and caught up in kind of like, I mean, the depression which comes with gambling as well, is because of, what's it down to, do you think? Is it down to the fact they've got loads of time on their hands? Is it down to the feeling of invincibility? Is it down to kind of like, I mean, having colourful characters around them who are leading them astray?
Yeah, I think, you know, all sport, you have a problem with all sport, whatever sport it is, that you get so much free time. I mean, if you probably practice in the morning from 9 till 1 o'clock or something, 4 hours practice, then, of course, you've got all afternoon and all night. If you're not working at night doing an exhibition or even, you know, going out or whatever, you've got that much free time. I know for a fact there's one Chelsea footballer who was getting over £150,000 a week has just remortgaged his house through gambling. So he's, like, on millions of pounds a year. And he's had to remortgage his flat. And there's so many Premiership footballers that are gamblers, big gamblers. It's like when they're playing the bus, you know. I mean, because they've got that kind of money, they're not playing three-card brag for a tenner or each or something like that. They're playing for thousands. I mean, I think it was Gary Gillespie many years ago. He was an Irish player, I think, isn't he? I think he lost 100,000 on one coach trip to a match. And then they've got to try and play the match. You just lose all proportion of money. That's the problem.
I mean, but like, I mean, eventually though, like, you do have to. A stop sign does come along, and like, I mean, you reach that kind of low. And in your case, you know, I mean, you definitely reached the stage where you had to.
I think the only time the stop sign comes along when you're not kind of Willie Thorne the snooker player, or you're not so and so the footballer. You know, when you're guaranteed like decent money, and all of a sudden now you're not guaranteed because you're outside the top 16, and now you're playing a seeded player in the first round, and you could get beaten in the first round. That's when the problems start. I mean, my lifestyle was always great. You know, even though I was, you know, winning and losing and things. I mean, many, many times I'd be, you know, £50,000-£60,000 up on a day and things like that, and thinking this is great, now everything's hunky-dory. And then the following week I might have done 100,000. You know, I mean, it's just stupid. I mean, you just lose all concept of money. And, of course, what comes with that is depression.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know me yet, but you can see I'm a pretty happy fella and things laughing and joking. But, you know, when I go back to the hotel room, I'll be like that. You know, I mean, because I'm depressed about what my life's become. You know, I use the words it could have been, should have been, might have been. Because there are the three things that happen to me, you know, when I'm thinking, well, if I'd have done this properly, I'd have won the World Championship a couple of times, maybe. And if I hadn't gambled, I'd had a house in wherever and this, that and the other. And I'd remortgaged my house so many times that luckily you know, I don't know whether it's going to be taken away from me yet, but I've got no equity in my house at the moment, so consequently they might not take my house away from me. But I mean, what a state to that is. I've earned a fortune over the years, yeah, on and off the table. Yeah. I've got nothing to show for it.
And aside from that as well, I mean, aside from the actual kind of, I suppose, figuring out the cost of it, there's also your head as well, the yo-yo factor in your head. On the one hand, you're gambling, and on the one hand, sometimes you have a winner, and there's a kind of like exhilaration that comes from kind of having a winner. On the other hand, you've got like the down that you've just described, that darkness when you go back to your room.
I think with gambling, you're always thinking it can happen tomorrow. Whether you're, if you're taking drugs, or you've got a mental health problem, or you're drinking, there's no kind of the excitement it could all change tomorrow. A gambler always thinks if he loses all his money and borrows 20 quid off his pal, that 20 quid could turn into 100 quid. You know, it's all multiples and things like that. And I think that's the bad thing with gambling, because you always dream of the next day, always dream of being that the big day. I mean, as I said before, I won £50,000 on a few occasions. I mean, one of my stories that's in the book is Gary Lineker, and I, as some of you may know, is my closest pal. I've been best man at his wedding. He was best man at my wedding. And when he was playing for Everton, I'd had £5,000 each way on Everton to win the FA Cup at 20-1. They've got to the final, and they're now playing Liverpool at Wembley. And I thought, well, I'm going to win whatever happens on the placement. I'm going to win 20 grand. They said, if they win, I'm going to win 140 grand. So I thought, well, I'm flying at the time as well. I think I was 100 grand in front with different bookmakers. So I'd had 5,000 quid on Gary Lineker to be the first goal scorer at 7-2. I'd had 15 grand, I think, on Everton to be in front of half time and full time at 9-2. At half time, it's 1-0 Everton. I stand to win £250,000 for 45 minutes of play. Liverpool won 3-1. So, I mean, you have spells where you think everything's going right, and then you have downers, and that's the problem with gambling. I don't know whether you get that with drugs or alcohol, because I've never done that, but you have so many downers when you've, like, lost your... I mean, the thing is, you end up telling white lies to your family, your friends, yeah, and all the rest of it. I'd come home and say I'd probably lost 8,000 quid or something, or 10,000 quid. And she'd still go, what have you been doing? I said, I went to the betting shop. Have you done any good? I said, I lost 500 quid. I said, nothing serious. You're telling fibs. And of course, when you're borrowing money, like I did over this last 6 months or so before I went bankrupt, I was borrowing money off friends. And of course, what you're saying to them is, look, I'm doing the UK Championship next week, I'm guaranteed X amount, so I can give you your back, or I'm doing this job, that job, I'm guaranteed this. And you end up telling that to five different people. And that is why it got to the state where, because I owed that much money at the time, I was borrowing money off moneylenders. They were a bit tricky. They threatened my wife. They threatened to chop her fingers off, one of them did, and then they threatened me and things like that, and I'm trying to keep it away from the wife. I'm trying to kind of bob and weave and duck and dive, and I'm borrowing more money off different people. And then, you know, I thought about suicide once, of which I came very, very close. And luckily, my stepson found me. I'd taken a load of pills. And when I came out of that side, I'm just trying to think to myself, how can I let all my family down? I mean, in my humble opinion, anybody that commits suicide is a coward, because you're not facing up to anything.
But is it also a case of, like, I mean, Willie, of kind of reaching out to someone as well? I mean, like, I mean, I read in your autobiography, you were kind of saying that, like, I mean, in some ways you had been treated, because you went to your doctor and he'd prescribed tablets for you. But, like, you know, you hadn't kind of, like, I suppose, explored in full with anyone the full extent of what you were going through.
Well, you think you're bulletproof, don't you? You don't think, you think you're going to get out of trouble, you think you're going to kind of win this amount, that amount, and become, you know, back in the game again. And I never wanted to kind of spiral out of control, because I knew what was happening, but all of a sudden I had to get back, you know, to such a state where I could live the lifestyle I'd lived. And that was the biggest problem, you know, in this recent time where allegedly they thought I was going to commit suicide, which, I mean, admittedly I did start to write letters and things, but this only happened about, I don't know, a year ago or something, when I knew, with getting threatened, I knew it was going to come to the end, as it were. For I was either going to get filled in, or my wife was going to get injured, and, you know, I owed one moneylender nearly 300 grand. And, of course, the interest, as you can imagine, was just colossal. And I thought, well, this is, you know, I can't go on like this. You know, I'm going to... The only way out for me is, you know, I commit suicide and, like, my wife gets let off, you know. And I was supposed to be at a meeting at 3 o'clock in Birmingham or somewhere. And I'm one of those sticklers for time. I'm never, ever late and things like that. And it came to about 3:30. And somebody rang my wife and said, look, Willie's not turned up for this meeting. Is he okay? And of course, alarm bells rang because Jill, I'd actually told Jill I was being threatened because I owed a lot of money and things like that. And she immediately rang half a dozen of the local hotels and couldn't find me there, and then rang another hotel. Eventually, she found the hotel where I was. Mr. Thorne checked in there. Yes, he's here. So obviously, they've got the police, ambulance, and all the rest of the thing. But I was actually in the room, kind of saying, what are you doing? Let them kill you if they want, but don't, like, you know, just be a coward again. And you thought about it once and got found, thankfully. You know, why are you even thinking about doing it again? And I'd actually wasn't going to do it that day, even though they burst into the room and things, and obviously I was crying, my wife was crying and all the rest of it. And, you know, it's just that do I get depression now? Of course I get depression now. You know, only because of what's happened to me in my life. All self-inflicted, by the way. I'm not blaming anybody at all. Okay, you know, if I hadn't gone in billy doors and things, I might never have gambled. But it was anyway at that time. I'd learned how to play snooker by going into these places, you know. And, of course, you know, my wife came in with the police and the ambulance and that, and even though I written notes, that there was no way. I'd already decided that, you know, I was just getting myself together, really, and there was no way I'd have done it that particular day. Mm. But, of course, the press then found out, because they've took me down to the hospital and things just to check I was all right mentally and things like that, and, of course, that got out in the press, and then all of a sudden, you know, they said Willie Thorne's attempted suicide, and, you know, it's just, unfortunately, the press, if you're a so-called celeb or whatever you call yourselves, I don't know, but they just take everything to the full. And I can't live with the press, and I can't live without them sometimes.
Well, that was kind of like my next question. I mean, just researching this interview and looking at the kind of like the way a certain section of the media has kind of covered your life. It's interesting. I mean, since you did kind of like the Strictly Come Dancing and, like, I suppose embrace that side of things, a lot of the kind of like tabloid press kind of like see you as kind of fair game in many ways, and they portray your illnesses in a very like unenlightened way.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was up for Strictly and The Jungle that particular time, and I thought this is a great chance now to kind of get a few quid. I think you guarantee being on Strictly at the time, I think it was 50,000 quid to be on Strictly. The Jungle gets between 50 and 100,000, depending on whatever. And I was dying to be in The Jungle because I thought this is great. I use the analogy of Phil Tufnell. I mean, Phil Tufnell was like myself. He was a little bit of a gambler, drinker and all the rest of it. And you could get Phil Tufnell for 300 quid to do an after dinner or something like that. He went from £300 per appearance to £10,000 winning The Jungle. So that was always in my mind, thinking, I've got to get in The Jungle. I can reinvent myself because I wasn't Willie Thorne the snooker player anymore. I've got to make myself Willie Thorne a celeb or something to try and get on this, that and the other. And, of course, Strictly came in. And came in first, unfortunately, and I'd have loved to have done The Jungle, but I mean, trust me, I mean, Strictly, as you can imagine, I'm not the most nimble man in the world, but my waltz was good. I had the pleasure of dancing with the lovely Erin Bogue. Now, prior to dancing with me, she'd danced with Peter Schmeichel, one of the fittest and greatest goalkeepers in the world. She'd danced with Martin Afire, one of the quickest and greatest rugby players in the world. She'd danced with Colin Jackson, Olympic medalist. Can you imagine her face when I walked in? I'm going to tell you a true story now. This is what happens with Strictly. In a theatre like this or in a big room like this, all the 16 celebrities, it's all Secret Service. John Barnes was Mr. Liverpool. I was Mr. Leicester. Kelly Brook was Miss whatever she was. And all the Brian Capron was on, Stephanie Beecham, Kenny and Gabby Logan, Dominic Littlewood. He was an arse, by the way, Dominic Littlewood. And all the dancers know where they are. So all of a sudden, we're coming in one at a time. Willie Thorne, you were dancing with Erin Bogue. All of a sudden, I can see her face drop. So I go up to her and said, Erin, really looking forward to it. You and your bow tie, bib and tucker, really looking forward to it. I'll see you on Monday. That's virtually the only conversation we've had. All the press photographs are done. We're now going back. On the following Monday now, Erin's coming down to the David Lloyd Centre in Leicester for our first training session. Stupidly, that morning, I've got twin boys, who at the time were about 9. I took them rugby training, you know, just a bit exercise, and I'd actually ripped my back. I thought, what a stupid thing to do. I'm just about to go on one of the biggest shows on television, and I've injured myself. So Erin's come in nice and bright. Willie, how are you doing? I said, Erin, I've got to apologise. I said, I'm a little stiff from rugby. She said, Willie, I don't care where you're from. We can win this. That was our first conversation with the lovely Erin Bogue, and that's a true story. That's a true story. A little stiff from rugby.
So, I remember there was an interview you did with someone after Taking Punt of My Life came out, and you were talking about the fact that how hard you found the kind of like promo of that, because you spent 2 days doing radio interviews, and you were talking again and again about like all that kind of the low points in your life. Do you find it really hard to still talk about that?
I've got to be honest, because I've done four or five radio interviews over the last couple of days. It has got me down. but I feel that I'm still alive to tell a story, and I feel that if I can just help one person from everything I've said, and if I can think that there's people out there to try and help you, it's not the end of your life, it's not the end of your world. Okay, yeah, you're not going to earn the thousands of pounds you used to earn, but, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And I think, and once again, I'm not supposed to talk about this, but I'm going to talk about it anyway, because hopefully... I've just done a program called Rich, Famous and Homeless, where I spent 5 days on the streets of London. There was myself, there was Nick Hancock, there was a lady from Country File called Fiona something, I can't remember her surname, and Kim and Aggie, remember the cleaning people? Kim, the blonde lady, she was on it, so four of us were there. So we get into this kind of real dingy place, and the guy from The Big Issue decided to do this to make the awareness. Because when The Big Issue first came out, homeless dropped dramatically. Over the last 5 or 6 years, it's gone up skyfold, right? In Dublin, as you know, there's 7,000 people in Dublin on the streets. In London, there's 15,000 people on the streets. So now we've given clothes. All we've given is a sleeping bag, a coat, and obviously we've got Long Johns and all the rest of it. They take your phone off you, take your money off you. The car's dropped us off. We've got two security guards with us at all times in case there's any aggravation or anything. And we've got three camera crews with us at all times. I was put on the streets in Brixham. All of a sudden I said to the camera crew, well, what happens now? I said, it's up to you. All we're allowed to do is give you water if you need water so you don't dehydrate. I met some of the most wonderful people on those streets. It nearly killed me. If you get a chance to watch it, it's going out in March for Sport Relief. It was one of the most humbling experiences I've had in my life. If I met 50 people at least that were homeless, 10 of them unfortunately got that bad mental illness or were that gone on drugs that it may take time to do that. But a lot of them could definitely be saved. I mean, allegedly we're 2 steps away from being homeless, everybody in this room, you know, that can be homeless at some stage. So 3 days we were on the streets fending for ourselves. I found soup kitchens. I found a place where, I kid you not, it's called the Acer Clubs in Clapham. And for £1, you can get a 2-course meal. And when I say 2-course meal, it was shepherd's pie or it was a minced beef, something or other. And a dessert, apple pie and custard or chocolate. Honestly, it was great. I mean, great for £1. And I'd meet people in there who were using that as their way to live. After 3 days, they called us in. And we talked about our experience. Once again, we were with the guys on the TV and that and all saying, well, you see how hard it is now. Now we're going to put you on the streets for the last 2 days with people that have been there on the streets. I got put with a guy from Denmark who been an alcoholic. He'd been now sober for 5 months. He would have looked no worse than any of us in the room now. You would have never known he was homeless. First 3 years on the street, he'd lived in Heathrow, going from terminal to terminal. The next 4 or 5 years, he'd lived on the buses, just going, because buses are 24 hours in London, going around the buses and things like that. And the last 2 years, he'd lived in a tent. Now, I'm looking at this guy thinking, how is he homeless? In his little briefcase, he'd got a bit of OCD, because he had one knife, one fork, one pen, one pair of scissors, one bootlaces. Everything was all lined up in his thing. This guy was, like I say, married, happily married, got a business, got a BMW. His wife left him for another man, turned him, started drinking, almost not alcoholic yet. His then business collapsed. You know, he'd got about 15 people working for him, small business, getting himself a nice few quid. Then became a alcoholic. Because of that, he wasn't paying the mortgage, lost his house. Didn't want to go back to Denmark because he wanted to save face and all the rest of it. And so he ended up on the streets. And like I said, he'd spent all these times either on the buses or whatever. He got an Oyster card, he got a bank account, his post came to one of the soup kitchens, so everything was all organised, right? I said, well, how do you earn a living? He said, well, what I do, Willie, I go to the pound shop, I buy 20 torches for £1 or 20 calculators for £1 and sell them for £3. And I'm thinking, well, why is he on the street? Why has he not got a flat and things like that? He said, Willie, I said, I'm not ready yet to go back into society. And I spent the first day with him, and then I said, well, where are we sleep? Because I didn't know at the time we'd got a tent. I said, well, where are we sleeping tonight? I'm thinking, because I spent the first 2 days on Brixham church steps, you know. And like I said, we had the security guards around. Because, I mean, obviously, with the camera crew being there, there was loads of homeless people kind of looking, what you're doing. I said, I'm homeless, blah, 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 and all the rest of it. Spent 2 days there. Spent another 2 days doing something else. One night in a hotel, because my legs had swollen up terrible, and I had to have a night in a hotel. And then, obviously, the last night, so I said, where are we sleeping? It's in a tent. Now, I'm thinking it's going to be a nice big tent. He's going to have all his clothes here. And then what I found out when I get in this tent, that's all he'd got. Not an item of clothing, yet he got everything properly. He only had a shower twice a week, but when in saying that, he didn't smell. You know, every day he went into a toilet or whatever and brushed his teeth and cleaned himself up. You would not know he was homeless at all. And that is the thing on the people you meet on the street. Not all of them are there because it's their own fault. A lot of them have been kicked out the home. Their wives have left them. There's so many different things on the street of which I've seen them all. You know, I've seen the drug addicts, I've seen the alcoholics, I've seen the mental health people. And it was such an humbling experience. And once again, it helped me in that way. Because, I mean, I know that I've been there and, you know, I could easily be homeless next week if they decide to take my house off me and all the rest of it. But, you know, it's so humbling. And I'm just trying to give you this point. Next time you see people on the street, just maybe spend a second to say, look, you know, why are you on the streets and things like that. And the, some of the stories you get is quite amazing. One of the girls that I met on the first day, because we were put in the centre of Brixham, and obviously I got the camera crew there and the security there, and the security always stayed 20 yards away or whatever. Plenty of people, oh, what are you doing here? You know, you're showing up at the homeless people. I said, no, listen, I'm homeless now. You know, I'd got my hat on, so people didn't recognise me and things like that. So I said, look, this is my first night on the street doing this homeless thing, and they're doing a documentary following me. And this one girl came out. Every person I'd spent time with, all the homeless people, why are you there, what happened, and all the rest of it. And this girl said, well, you know, I had two children very early on and I couldn't look after them, and my boyfriend left me in the lurch and I couldn't afford to keep them. They took them off me and I had nowhere to go. My mother didn't take me back in again, and so I've been living on the streets for 2 years. She was spent all the time with me, and when I went onto the church steps about 1 a.m, at 3 a.m, Willie, are you okay? Just checking you're okay. 5 a.m, Willie, you're okay. So what she was doing all the rest of the time, I don't know, but they look after each other on the streets. That's the beauty. It's only the people that don't understand why people are homeless, people that go up to them and wee on them while they're sleeping and things like that, or kick them and things like that. There's so much of that goes on. I don't know whether it goes on in Dublin, but, you know, the lads are out, 10 of them, and oh, let's wee on this fella here. And it's just, it's now given me a completely different outlook on the homeless.
Totally. I mean, does it kind of like, I suppose, make you think as well that we in kind of like, I mean, supposed to like mean, let's call it like mean that the people who are not homeless, sorry, we don't look after each other in the same way.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's obviously you all think everybody's all right. I mean, everybody in here is probably, you know, got a job and living, you know, a decent sort of life. Obviously, we'd like better jobs. We all would like better jobs where we have more money and things like that. But a lot of you would be content with your life. I've been content with what I've done over the years, but I'm not content with myself at the minute because I failed. You know, I failed with my family. I failed with my mother, God bless her, died 2.5 years ago. And that was the crux of when I went off the rails this second time, because, you know, my mother was my rock. And when you see this documentary that goes out in March, we started talking about parents and things like that. And so I broke down a few times when I'm talking to Pierre. He was a lovely, lovely fella. And he'd been through all this, you know, losing his wife, losing his stillborn baby. He did all this, losing his business. And you can quite easily see how people do end up on the street. But there again, there'll be people out there thinking, well, why should they just get a job? As you know, sometimes jobs are not freely available. You know, it's not something that's easily available, and you can't always get the job you want. And some people don't want to work because they can find it easy to be on the dole. And all of a sudden, then they're on the dole and they're spending their money. And, you know, it's a vicious circle sometimes.
I'm curious as to, like, I mean, what stage you're at yourself at the moment in your head? You know, I mean, like, have you stopped gambling? You know, and I know you've had, like, some terrible health problems in 2015 with the cancer diagnosis, the stroke. You know, I mean, where in your head, where are you at right now?
I've finished gambling. Don't get me wrong, I still do the lottery because that's my only hope. I mean, I've got to be honest. I mean, I'm sure you'll all do the lottery tonight because it's about 58 million, isn't it, or something? But you've got more chance of being struck by lightning, apparently, than winning the lottery. But at least if you don't buy a ticket, you can't win, can you? I mean, I'm in a place where at the minute where I'm not interested in gambling. It cost me my first marriage. You know, I had a wonderful house in Leicestershire and one of the nicest houses in Leicester. Through gambling, that cost me my first marriage. I ran away, and of course, unfortunately, the property crash happened at the same time, whereas the house was up for about 600 grand at that time, which in this day and age would be about 1.5 million or something. And it got sold for 280 grand in the end after the property crash, you know. So it was just circumstances. My timing has always been crap, you know. I've got to be honest. Everything that's gone wrong has always been through timing, you know. And that was the first one. And the beauty of it, I mean, I'm so lucky at the minute. I mean, I'm married to a full Miss Great Britain, 1985, she won Miss Great Britain. Obviously, I'm batting well above my weight, as you can imagine. But and she stood by me through all this.
Yeah.
I mean, how she put up with me over the last... I mean, she knows I was a gambler when I met her, but she didn't know to what extent. The only thing I would say that I've never lost my last penny. Say, for instance, I got 500 quid in my pocket. I would never lose 500 quid. I would lose 400. But I'd make sure if my wife wanted to go out for dinner, we could go out for dinner. If she wanted to go to a night in a hotel, I could pay for a night. I never, ever let her know that it was the end. And so I wasn't a complete nutcase at gambling, but obviously what's happened, it seems like I am. But I always kept money so we could drink and eat and all the rest of it, and she wouldn't know, you know, that's how bad it was.
Before we kind of turn it out to the audience, get some questions from them, you know, I mean, I suppose I want to bring it back to the snooker, because you're still very much in the game. You're still kind of like commenting for the BBC.
Yeah.
Like, you said something, we were talking about this last night, and you were kind of like talking about the players today, and you kind of gave me the impression you think everything is soft. You think, like, I mean, you'd have no problem, cataracts aside, you'd have no problem kind of like going back into the game because of the way the game has changed. You talked about heated tables, and, you know, it struck me that kind of like you think things are a lot easier now.
Well, this is a miserable old man talking. I mean, everything in sport has improved, and in snooker, ridiculously. In our day, you played on thicker cloths, heavier balls. If it was damp outside, you know, they would get into the tables, and that's why you always had to play with side to kind of help the white speed up, to, you know, breaking off. You'd sometimes go to an exhibition at a club 25 years ago, and to break off and get the white back in balk was hard work. You know, that's how much, I'm sure some of you played on those tables. Of course, now they've got table eaters underneath them. They've got lighter balls, so consequently, when you go into the pack, they smash up all over the place. I would have loved to play, because break building was my forte. I wasn't the greatest safety player. I wasn't the greatest temperament. But when I was in the balls, I was as good as anybody. I'd have loved to play it in today's game, because the ball just split nice and everything's perfect. And not to kind of go on about it, but I mean, you have to be a plain ball player at the minute. You have to hit the white in the centre, you know, because if you put any sort of side on it, it swerves all over the place. All the players that are winning at the moment, Robertson, plain ball, Ronnie O'Sullivan, plain ball, you know, all the great players now have been helped by the conditions. So that's a biased old man talking, but that's true.
What do you make of kind of like me and supposed to the new Asian whiz kids on the scene?
There's not many. We thought Judd Trump was going to be an absolute superstar, and he probably might still be, but he's now been in the game 10 years, and I'm a bit disappointed. You know, when I commentate on people, I love to commentate on Judd Trump. I love to commentate on Ronnie O'Sullivan, because they do the same thing that I wanted to do, you know, around the black spot. Obviously, when you're doing commentary, you've got to be very careful, because you can get yourself in trouble. I mean, Ted Lowe, many years ago, came out with what we call the first faux pas on television. He was commentating on the great Fred Davis at the time, and Fred was 67 years of age. He was trying to reach over to play the shot, couldn't quite reach it, so he decided to get his leg on the table to play the shot. He still couldn't reach it, so he decided to play the shot left-handed. To which Ted Lowe, going out live on Grandstand on a Saturday afternoon, said, "Well, there you are, ladies and gentlemen, at 67 years of age, Fred Davis, a little bit too old to get his leg over. He realised he was in trouble and tried to get away by saying he prefers to use his left hand instead." Now,
have you ever come close to replicating something like that?
When you do commentary, you have to be very careful. He just asked me whether I've done anything quite like that. John Parrott actually beat that faux pas 4 years ago at the World Championship at Sheffield. Those who watch the BBC television will know that Steve Davis and John Parrott normally do the studio. Dennis Taylor, Virgo, and myself are in the commentary box. All of a sudden, the powers that be at the BBC said, "Look, we're trying to get John and Steve to do a bit of commentary. Do you mind if John Parrott comes and sits next to you to get his first day on commentary?" No problem. Now, in our commentary position, we have two monitors, so we can see what's happening on the monitors. We're also quite high up, so we can see what's happening on the table. I knew by not only looking at the monitors, but also looking out on the table, that Mark Williams was playing this first round match. I knew they could definitely pot the pink, because the reds were spread. I knew after potting this red, he could definitely pot the pink, but I wasn't too sure, because I couldn't tell whether the angle's here or there, whether the black was available. So I thought, I'll play safe, I'll bring John in. Come, "Well, John, great pot on the red there from Mark Williams. I think he'll take the pink now." No sooner as I said that, the camera angle changed on the monitors. We now could see not only could he pot the pink in the middle, he could get through this little gap of reds to pot the black. So Parrott realised I'd made a mistake. I've gone, "Well, John, I think he'll take the pink here." Parrott, going out live, has gone, "Well, he's got a black, will he? But I think it'd be a tight squeeze." Live to the nation. So those kind of things can happen all the time. I mean, there's been so many faux pas in commentary over the years, hasn't there? I mean, the great Harry Carpenter was once to say on the Oxford-Cambridge boat race, when he said, isn't that great, the president of the Oxford crew is kissing the cocks of the Oxford crew. I mean, those kind of things come out all the time, but they're faux pas. They happen. Yeah. They happen.
Last question for me, William. Thank you very much for your time. Last question for me. A couple of years ago, you did an interview at The Guardian, and the interviewer asked you at the end of it, who do you rate when it comes to moustaches? And at that time, you said, regarding moustaches.
Okay.
At the time, you kind of said you had moustache envy regarding the great Dermot Desmond, the financier, and we know him here in Dublin for various reasons, but he's the largest shareholder at Celtic FC. Whose moustache do you rate these days?
Oh, good question. Tom Selleck? He's up there, isn't he? There's not many moustaches about these days, is he? I mean, honestly, there could be Japs in here thinking the war's still on. That's how long I've had my moustache. I mean, I've had my moustache so long. I mean, the thing is, because I was like 14, 15 years age and playing snooker, which was an older man's game, I actually grew a moustache, sincerely, just to be like one of the crowd, you know, because, I mean, when I turned pro at 21, as I mentioned earlier on, I mean, everybody else was 35 and 40, so I wanted to be grown up, and that was the way I found to be grown up, you know. When I was going bald, I hated it. I mean, I was horrified at going bald, but in retrospect, it's been the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. It's made me kind of easily recognisable. A lot of people have, you know, I'd be walking down the street with Gary Lineker, and they'll notice me before Gary. You know, the fact that I'm blocking him out because I'm so bloody fat is another story. But you know, that has been my life. Everybody knows me with my stash. Everybody knows me with my thing. You know, I've got to get some, you know, I've got to get fitter, though. I mean, I put a stone and a half on since just before Christmas because of the depression again and kind of being in trouble. Last time I tried to lose weight, I bought one of those Jane Fonda videos to try and lose weight. On a golden pond. I never knew why I didn't lose any weight. But, I mean, there we are.
Okay, I think we've got some time for some questions from the floor. We've got a microphone here, so I'm going to ask, if you've got a question, just put your hand up, and we'll try and... I think we can get the microphone to you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much.
Thank you,
Tanya.
Yeah, it's a snooker question about one of the best modern-day players, Ronnie O'Sullivan. I remember I saw him play at Goffs. It was the unfortunate time where his title got stripped because it turned out he was smoking something. So they stripped his title, if you remember. But I'm just saying that you were talking about, say, the modern age, players have it easier, blah, blah, blah. You hear the same thing about Premiership footballers. Like John Giles, one of our old pundits here, is always going on
Legend
about how he played 52 games and they never heard of metatarsals and blah, blah, blah.
And on pitches that were kind of knee-deep in mud.
Yeah, they could play with hangovers and all that type of thing. I know some of it's nonsense because I don't think... It's a different game. Players look after themselves better now. I'm just wondering, like, someone like Ronnie O'Sullivan, like, how does he compare to all the greats that you've played with?
Let me say this, right? I can understand what you're saying. I would never say that the players these days are not as good as we were. They're different class. I mean, the top three or four players, I talk of Hendry at his height, O'Sullivan at his height, Steve Davis at his height. I mean, obviously, Steve Davis in my era, but those two players, I put Ding now, I put Robertson in that category. Those four would have beat us in those days. But what the conditions have done is brought everybody else closer to them. You know, people like Nigel Bond, who couldn't win in our era, is now still in the top 32, and I think he's just dropped out of the top 32 now. But he was still competing up until a few years ago. There's older players now that are still... I mean, Ken, bless his dear heart. You know, I mean, he's nowhere near the player he was and still can compete at a decent level. You know, I mean, we've got John Higgins now, who's well past his sell-by date, but he's still winning tournaments. It's brought everybody closer together because it's so easy now to break build. Don't get me wrong, you've still got to pot them, but it's an easier thing to do now. I mean, very rarely now. I mean, O'Sullivan, in my humble opinion, is the greatest player of all time. If he realised how difficult the game was, he would enjoy it more. He thinks if he's not making a 70 breaker above every frame, he's playing bad. He's got no concentration whatsoever these days, and he's playing in the Benson Hedges next week. Sorry, they keep calling it the Bensons, but he's playing in the Masters starts tomorrow for the first time this year. He's not played in a tournament since he lost to Stuart Bingham in the final of the World Championship. O'Sullivan is different class, without any question. You know, he's the only person when I'm commentating I want the other person to miss just so I can watch Ronnie play, because he does everything good. He does everything perfect.
Yeah, just on that, and the last question I want to ask it is, okay, compared to someone like Alex Higgins... Alex Higgins was a brilliant player. How good would he have been had he not been so mad in the drink?
I don't want to offend anybody from Ireland, right? But Alex Higgins was the greatest shot maker of all time. Break builder, no good. Alex Higgins made 75, I think, competitive centuries. Ronnie O'Sullivan's just made his 800th. I've made over 200 in competitive play. Parrott's made 400. Henry's made 700. Alex Higgins made 73 or 75. As a shot maker, the greatest I've ever seen. He made a 69 break in the UK in the final of the World Champions, semi final of the World Championship against Jimmy White, which to this day is still the best break I've ever seen, because he was never in position. Alex Higgins' positional was not very good, but he can make the white ball talk. I mean, he did more for our game than any other player has ever done. You know, I don't know why in this country do we like the naughty boys. You know, we like the Gazzers in football. We like the Frank Bruno who lost all the time, and we like the Higgins of this world. I mean, Alex Higgins won two World Championships, won about another four or five good tournaments. If he hadn't have gone off the rails, would he have won more? Definitely yes. But would I put him in the same class as Hendry, O'Sullivan, or John Higgins? I wouldn't put him in that class at all. But a great, great player. Shot maker, unbelievable.
Okay, thank you very much. Another question. Two rows back there. We'll see if we can get the microphone back.
Oh, a lady. That would be a pleasure to answer to a lady. Madam.
Firstly, I'm a big snooker fan, and we're going to the World Championships in April, so we're very excited about that. I just wanted to ask about the World Championships. Do you see it remaining in Sheffield for much longer with Hearn's push towards China, or there is no way the players will let it go elsewhere?
Well, let me say this. I don't know whether you watch snooker. I mean, the Crucible Theatre for me is like Wimbledon is for tennis. They're never going to move Wimbledon from tennis. I think it'd be such a retrograde step to move snooker away from the Crucible. There's only 900 and odd people, I think it's 963 or something, or 863 can watch the Crucible. The atmosphere at the Crucible, if you're snooker fans and you've never been to the Crucible, please make an effort before you're kind of too old to travel or whatever to go and watch a snooker match at the Crucible. The atmosphere is unbelievable. Backstage is the worst you've ever seen. Mark Williams got himself in trouble because he was saying how bad the Crucible was, but he was talking about the facilities backstage. I mean, I'd love to take you to the Crucible, all of you, and say, look, well, this is great, but I would have nowhere to, apart from sitting in the auditorium, I've got nowhere backstage where you can sit and have a cup of tea and have a meal or something like that. Before tobacco sponsorship ended, the embassy did it right. They had two marquees outside the Crucible where you could have dinner, you could bring guests there, and he made a day of it. Now we're struggling for things like that. Should it ever go away from the Crucible? 100% not. And I think while Barry Hearn's still involved, it may not go away from the Crucible. I sincerely hope it doesn't. I think we've just signed another contract with the Crucible, I think, for another 5 or 6 years at least. So certainly the next 5 or 6 years. Should they have a World Series? I think what they should do is a bit like the golf. Okay, keep the World Championship with the World Championship, but have an Open or something, call it the Scottish Open, the Welsh Open. Just move it around. I mean, golf's used to be the... Just we used to love coming over and playing in Ireland. I mean, the people are just so friendly. You know, everything's like they love the snooker and things like that. Some great players, and Goss was a great venue, but they don't seem to have anything big here as far as snooker's concerned. Obviously, they have the Legends Tour, and that gets sold out. They have, I think, Ronnie O'Sullivan was over here playing Jimmy White a few months ago somewhere in Dublin or whatever, and they've had 2,000 people there watching. So, you know, why not have a World Championship? I'm trying to think of a word they can use. Obviously, they can't have the world. They can call it the Masters or something,
yeah.
Or whatever, you know, just to move it round every year. Move it round every year, but hopefully never take it away from the Crucible.
Thanks.
Next question. Just put your hand up. Yep, woman in front row.
Hello, my name is Alan.
I've signed an autograph for you, Alan.
Thank you. Very fond of the snooker. But just as regards the gambling, have you just... sort of stayed with one type of gambling, or have you tried lots of different things?
When I'd say lost a lot of money in one particular day, now and again I go to a casino. Definitely horses was my only real gambling. I mean, we all play poker on the circuit and things, and you know, but I would never play cards with somebody, because half the time, anybody that can manipulate cards, you know, I would never play with a stranger at cards, because I've seen people do things with cards that, you know, just frightening, you know. So I'd always be reluctant to play cards, but after losing, you know, money in any one day, if I was in a different town, I'd probably try and think, well, I'll go and spend $2,000 in a casino, try and get the $10,000 back I've just lost or something like that. So
what would you play in? Blackjack.
I like to be able to say yes or no, whereas at roulette you just go like that and you've either won your money or lost your money. At least with blackjack you can say no or yes, you know. That's so blackjack, really. I've never played dice. I don't know.
Okay,
I've never played
craps.
Thank
you, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, madam.
Time for one or two more questions. Anyone's got anything else?
Anybody near the back? All gone shy all of a sudden, have we?
All gone shy.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, white hoodie here, there. And then the guy behind him.
Oh, yeah, perfect. We're with you in a sec, thank you. Yes, sir.
Hello, Willie. In your era, the real bowl boys, Jimmy White, Alex Higgins, Kirk Stevens, we knew about Higgins and his drink problems. We knew about White's subsequently and his drug problems. Stevens was the only one that really came out with a drug problem. How prevalent was it really? Because it seemed to be a clean sport.
I think in all sports, you can have people, we read about it in football, we read about it in rugby, I don't know what it's like in Gaelic football or anything like that, but there's all people that are on drugs. You know, I mean, you hear about people getting, you know, banned and things. Cause, I mean, drug tests have been brought in to all sports now to make sure that it's clean, but people have got ways around of getting it. I mean, I remember many years ago that Cliff Thorburn got banned for, I think, 2 months for smoking marijuana, but he was going out with Ronnie Wood from the Rolling Stones, so what do you expect? You know, I mean, it's a... I mean, Jimmy White, as you know, has got a few problems, and I fear for Jimmy White. I mean, I think he's the most wonderful, brilliant player. Should have definitely won the World Championship on 2 or 3 occasions. But Jimmy, unlike myself, who luckily can go out and speak at a dinner or do lots of sporting dinners, we were involved in a management company, we look after loads of different people. Jimmy, I don't know what he's going to do when he suddenly... I mean, he's still getting $2,000 to an exhibition, and he does plenty of them, you know, because he's still doing them. But I fear for him because he's like myself. He's gambled. You know, he likes to do all the things that I've never done the drug side of things, but allegedly he does like to do things on that department. I think he's going to come a day when all of a sudden he can't get his exhibition fees anymore and Jimmy will be in trouble. And I hope not, because he's been a marvellous attribute to our game, and I would hate to see him go down the road of the great Alex Higgins did.
Great.
Gentlemen behind you, sir.
Hi, Willie. First of all, thanks very much for a very entertaining chat. One thing that just crossed my mind is, as I was talking to you, you mentioned Ken, and 20 years ago he would have been a far better player than he is now. I would have grown up watching, obviously, the likes of Stephen Hendry being untouchable and then going from untouchable to beatable. Just in a general sense, and then from your own point of view, is there one particular day... I mean, it's not like a footballer when does his cruciate and he's 33, it's over. It's one particular day where you go, I'm not as good as I was.
That's a great question, because some people last a long time, but there's always times when you're thinking, gee whiz, I can't do this anymore, and you end up missing balls you never used to miss. I mean, towards Hendry's latter part of his career, he'd miss a ball that he wouldn't have missed in the previous 20 years. It's not because of nerves. I think what it is, your hand-eye coordination sometimes goes, you know, you get... When you're playing good, when you're at the height of your career, you know you're either going to pot it or hit the jaws. You know, you very rarely, unless you twitch or something, you're going to miss a ball by miles. When I talk about hand-eye coordination, something in the epistat of the brain is telling you something different, because you're hitting the ball still exactly where you thought you did it 10 years ago, but you're now missing the ball. So something's lying to you somewhere, you know, through your arm and all the rest of it. This happens to everybody. It's an age thing. You talk about Gaelic football, you can talk about... English football or whatever you can talk about, there's sometimes in the game where all of a sudden you have to say, look, I'm too old. And this is what's happening to Jimmy at the minute. He's still playing, and God bless him, he loves the game so much he wants to continue playing. If he wasn't doing the exhibitions, Jimmy White would already have been potless now, but the exhibitions are keeping him on, in a good life. I mean, he still drives a Bentley and all that, so he's still earning plenty of money. But, you know, I think there comes to a stage in any sport where all of a sudden you've got to say, look. And the only reason I packed in is because I couldn't see anymore. I mean, I say I couldn't see anymore. My right eye was definitely weak, and if I try to hit a ball thin on that side or even kind of, you know, hit it thick, you know, I'd either hit it too thin or too thick. You know, that side of the table was hard. So I had to pack in through sight problems. But I think any player that's been at the top of the game, like a Davis, a Parrott, or, you know, a Jimmy, I want to remember them as they were. You know, I actually sickens me sometimes now to see Jimmy playing. It very rarely gets on television these days, but when you commentate on him now, and of course you still commentate on the way you knew he was playing, and of course you keep saying, oh, that's a bad miss from Jimmy, and, you know, his safety plays crap, he can't get past the ball line sometimes now with safety, because, you know, all of a sudden everything becomes difficult the older you get, and of course you get previous. I mean, towards the end of my career, I was missing probably 3 or 4 blacks off the spot in a 9-frame match. in my good part, even though I wasn't the best player in the world, I would never miss a black off a spot, because I mean, that was my forte around that end. But you end up like missing easy balls. I mean, there's been so many easy balls missed over the years. And of course, Jimmy White, going back to Jimmy, when he led Hendry 14-8 and he missed the easiest black in the world you've ever seen. And of course, Hendry then thought, oh, Jimmy's struggling to get over the winning post. I think in all sports now, I don't know whether you agree with me or not, but I think it's almost 50-50 now, ability and temperament. I think it's got that close. I think the stronger mind people look at the likes of, don't get me wrong, Dennis is a great player, but is he good enough to win the World Championship? I'm not sure. Joe Johnson. I mean, goodness me, how would Joe Johnson... Now listen, I'm the most jealous man in the world that Dennis Taylor and Joe Johnson won the World Championship and I never did, you know. And Jimmy, he must be kicking himself thinking, well, you know, I think, you know, if you're right and you can play great for a fortnight at a time, you can win the World Championship. But would they ever win it again? No. You know, it's a strange one, really. It's a difficult one to come to terms with when you get to an age where you can't do it anymore.
Another question at the end of the table there. I think this could be the last question. I think it might be something
Well done, Willie. Very good stuff. I hope you're over the trip in from the airport yesterday and through the tunnel and all that kind of stuff. But I have two questions, one serious, one not so serious. You mentioned that your family were a huge help to you to overcome your suicidal situation. But what in your own head turned your feelings to living rather than dying?
As I said to you all, the second time, when I, just 6 months ago, when I allegedly, they all thought I was going to commit suicide, and I must admit, when I first went out there, I might have been considering doing it, but when sitting in the hotel room, it's what I've still got in life. I've got a wonderful wife. I've got three children. I've got twin boys who are 30, both doing the twin boys. One's a tailor at Deason Skinner on Savile Row. My other son has bought a gastro pub and it's doing great. My daughter's a hairdresser, so I don't see her very often. Don't worry, though. I've got my own shampoo coming out. It's called Shoulders. Make sure you buy that. But, you know, that knowing that I've got wonderful children, knowing I've got a wonderful wife, my life, in fairness, is great. You know, I mean, I go to nice things. I do nice things like this. I get invited to do things like this, which is obviously, you know, a pleasure to come over and chat about my downfalls and things. Hopefully it will help somebody. Go to nice places on holiday. Okay, I can't at the minute because I'm, you know, broke, but I mean, I still got, you know, time to do nice things. I get invited to all the great golf tournaments, playing all the prams, and I must just say this, I had the pleasure of playing with Christy O'Connor on two occasions, and joined the Master. One of my closest friends on the golf circuit is a fellow called Mark Rowe, who does work for Sky now, and on two occasions, Mark and Christy have been joined together. And I obviously was walking around watching all the 18 holes or 36 holes they played together with his lovely wife, Chris's wife, Anne. And he's the most wonderful guy. And I think this is the key thing. A lot of celebs have no time for the public. I think, in fairness, what is wrong with people? I mean, they've put you there. They've made you be that certain person. Christy was the most wonderful. We had time for everybody. When we played in the Masters, it was like, you know, they used to have a celebrity, obviously the pro, and two amateurs. He'd spend time with all those people, you know. And so, you know, looking at kind of why I wanted to commit suicide or something like that, I then thought, what are the good things in life? And, people don't know me in the room, but, you know, if you talk to me, I'll talk to you. You know, I mean, I don't ever refuse an autograph. I always got time for somebody, unless they're drunk. Obviously, I'd say, look, I'm a bit busy at the minute. I've got to do something. I think it costs nothing to be nice.
And you obviously don't need Joe Hart shampoo, anyway, that's for sure.
Yeah, Joe Hart. Well, I must admit, I once got, funny enough, I did get a chance to do an advert for furniture polish. But it's true. I mean, Pledge came to me. I did an advert for Tugard Lava, but... if you may or may not remember, I used to have about six strands of hair that I used to stick there. I used to stick down with gel. Seriously, this is true. I never thought I was going bald until I saved those six hairs off. Right? And I tell you, what was the guy? The woman who was married to Sylvester Stallone?
Bridget Nielsen.
Right? We're at a dinner one night. This is honestly true. We're at a dinner. She's on my. I'm on her table. She's on my table. Whatever. And I've got these six hairs plastered down with gel. Literally, it was an habit. Every time somebody took a photo of me at that time, I'd always go like that to make sure those six hairs were straight, right? And she were on the table having dinner, and she said, why are you hanging on to those six hairs? Now I'm thinking, this woman who's had the worst hairstyle of 20, you know, she's had it here, there and everywhere. She's telling me to, and I thought, why am I holding on to these six hairs, right? I've gone, this is true, for the first time I've gone to the room that night and chopped them off. That is the first time I thought I was bald. And I've been hanging on to these six hairs. I had the old comb over for like 10 years. And when I say those, so it was Bridget Nielsen's fault I went bald.
The last question then, Willie, is what happened to Teddy Bear?
What happened to the Teddy Bear?
Yeah.
Well, it was a new girlfriend at the time, and put it this way, it was worth giving her the Teddy Bear.
Ladies and gentlemen, Willie Torn.
Nice to see you all. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks for listening.
Many thanks to Willie for joining us at Banter and being so candid about his life to date, and thanks to Dave Reed, JP Swain, and all of the First Fortnight Festival for their help. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another one. Until then, goodbye and take care.